Welcome everyone to the Audit Committee. We've received apologies from Mike Ramsey, so the first order of business will need to be to appoint a chair.
Could I move Councillor Smale?
A seconder? Councillor Harris.
Thank you all for this moment of déjà vu as Chairman of the Audit Committee. Do we have apologies?
Apologies, as I said, Mike Ramsey and Councillor Parry.
Are there any issues with the order of business? Are there any declarations of interest? You may raise a declaration at any time in the proceedings. Can we now look at the minutes of the previous meeting on page 5 to 12? Are we content with the minutes? Are there any issues arising from the minutes? Former Councillor De Vink.
Thank you. The non-voting member of the Audit Committee. On page 7, 5-2, there is a brilliantly drafted minute of what took place, but I don't think it really reflects my great anxiety about the Treasury management, and I feel that that needs to be redrafted. I'm happy to provide a wording for it, but at the time I did say that I felt that we as a council ran huge risks if we invested in what I considered Mickey Mouse financial institutions. Maybe that's a bit critical, but basically, I want to raise this later on because I think this council should only back companies that are under the immediate influence of the Bank of England guarantees that are available to British banks.
Thank you for returning that. The expression I think that matters here is concerns remained regarding the risk exposure which was associated with the approach taken by the council to Treasury management. I think that rather covers the general subject, but no doubt we'll hear a little bit more later in the meeting about any potential developments of our Treasury policy from you.
Yeah, but what I would like to do is to see that my name as the non-voting member of the Audit Committee is associated with the flags that I raised on that particular issue.
So if we add that independent member De Vink expressed concerns remained regarding the risk exposure, happy to do that? Thank you. Can we now look at the action page? Outstanding actions, number one, I think that's closed off. It's on the agenda. Complete. January 2019, if we're spared, complete. Alistair?
I can give an update on that just so we're ahead there. So that's to confirm following audit recommendations. We can confirm that all our care homes are now using the council egress system, and they've been using that for the last 6 months. We do a test with them to make sure they continue to send emails backwards and forwards. I suppose just a comment in relation to the action that relates to staff arrears. So that wasn't purely about health and social care staff arrears, that was council staff arrears. So we have details about what the current staff debt is at the moment, if that would be helpful for the committee to be aware of.
Do you want to report on that now?
Yeah, so the current staff debt at the moment, and recognising that it's a dynamic number, but it's £821,000.
So it's not very much declined from its peak, which was near a million. No doubt that people come off it having serviced their debt and then others fall into arrears. There being no further comments, we move to financial monitoring on page 15. Thank you. There's a data analytics presentation in the public reports.
So we thought it would be useful today for both William and Alistair just to present on some of the work that's been happening behind the scenes on both automation and on data analytics. We've talked a lot about the step change that we need to make in terms of moving towards real-time data to help us with proactively monitoring a whole range of different things across the council. So at first I'm going to hand over to William Fortune, who's done a great deal of work here, and then I'll pass over to Alistair Short. We're also very thankful to NSS also for their external support that they've given us in terms of where we host this information, and also as part of the South East of Scotland city deal. The aspiration, of course, from the university is to become the data capital of Europe. So I think we're in good hands in terms of the progress that we can make, and we certainly have enough experts around who can assist us. So I'll hand over to William for the first part of the presentation.
Excuse me. So, at present, heads of service and directors are receiving this sort of spreadsheet which details all the figures for mileage and expenses and earnings claimed, and it's quite difficult to see at a glance that information, and it's just a row of numbers. So it was trying to create a dashboard that made it more visible and accessible for managers to actually see the information. So we give them like numbers for that month. So at the moment it's up to date. This is the live data as of November's payroll. So it gives us the average days lost for absences, the average monthly earnings, and the total mileage claims for that month. And we also have a breakdown over year, over the last 12 months. So this is council-wide. And then we've also split it down by gender, so male and female. As you can see, there's a peak here for January 2018. The mileage was greater. It's quite hard to tell that on the spreadsheet. And there's nothing there that jumps out at you to say that this was happening. So it's just to make the data more relevant, more accessible for the managers, so they can see, and they can see their trends as to what's happening. So we can drill down further, so we can go in from the big overview and down into absence, which we've now broke it down into directorate. However, on the right hand side here, we've got the legend colour code and filters that we can do it by month. So all the information's still there. It's just you're a couple of clicks away from actually drilling down and finding that information. And if you click on a directorate, it brings back the service. It's going forward, we're looking at taking that down to a reporting unit level, so it's actually at the service manager's fingertips. At the moment, it's just live for heads of service and directorates. And again, we've been trying to be consistent with the colour, use of colours here, so you know that pink's female and blue's male. We can also change the measure, so we can go from full-time days equivalent lost to average days lost quite quickly. And again, we've got the same for earnings and for mileage as well. We can drill down further. Again, we've been trying to be consistent, so you know where you are, regardless of what dashboard that you're looking at, that you can see. If you click here, that'll take you down to another level. The filters are all in the same place. I'm just trying to make it more intuitive and make it much easier for managers to actually get their hands on the information that they need and when they need it. There's been a big push to save time, because at the moment this spreadsheet takes 3 days to produce. There's a lot of data manipulation takes place to get it at that format. I've managed to get it down to 2 hours, including uploading it to the server. Hopefully with increased automation we'll get that done to under an hour, so the data can be refreshed much more frequently if required. Again, mileage again, you can filter it, same places. You can do it by payroll if we needed to for this one. Actually, there's not as much mileage in 662 as there is on, but for health and social care. And again, we can drill down, and it gives you a breakdown as to where the mileage claims are happening.
And it's just and to make it red is female and blue is male?
Yes. And going forward, I mean, this is just the first draft, if you like. It was taken from a proof of concept and taking it, putting it live. But obviously, we don't know all the questions that the managers need to answer. So we've given them matching what in the spreadsheet, but there may be some other information that they think, no, we actually need this and we need that. Once it's out and live and the questions can be asked of the data themselves, then we can provide more accurate information. I think the next phase is to include finance data regarding waste and health and safety. But we've got a working group looking at all the where all the information comes from and how we can join it all together. I mean, because it's stored in the NSS, it's hopeful we can actually tie in with other things like the NHS data and our social care data and everything and bring it all together. So it's everything's in one place that we can just talk to each other properly. No trying to find a spreadsheet from over here to match up with a Word document over there. And just try and get everything out there as quickly as possible. And I think that's pretty much me. Is there any questions?
Fascinating. Very, very, very impressive. But the mileage is a total, while the earnings is an average. How many people would use mileage, and could you also give an average figure for that?
If that's what's required, I mean, if we go into the mileage dashboard, if it works, please. That just gives the overall figures at this point, but as I say, we don't know exactly what they're going to be used for by the managers until it's out there and used. We can do that, we can find out the numbers involved, so if you hover over it, it doesn't actually tell you on this one. There's some of them that tell you the actual numbers involved in each directorate, in each service, and we can build that picture onto that wee hover over there, so when you hover over it, you can actually see more information that you need.
Councillor Muirhead. Councillor Milligan, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm taking it with this information that the basis of having all this information will allow us to cut down journey times and to cut down claims in that aspect, and that will be able to be spread right across the board. I mean, I take it with data analytics. Will it come down to the likes of the question that was asked to Alistair just before there, what was the debt for staff? Will we be able to go in and just be able to see a pressure button, how many arrangements have been put in place for the total for to recover that kind of debt? Is that the kind of thing this will allow us to do?
Yes, that's the intention, certainly, is to have as much information available to the people who need it so they can make up-to-the-minute decisions.
Councillor Muirhead.
Yeah, I'm conscious of the fact that what you were saying there was about the amount of time it takes to prepare the spreadsheets and bring them up to date. And obviously the ideal situation to be in was where that kind of front end tied into your systems in the background and there didn't have to be that manual intervention. I know that we've been having a look at methods from other sort of external companies that can help us to not only produce this kind of thing but actually draw the information from our systems on an automatic basis. I take it that that would be where we would be going with this, because it doesn't seem to me, you want to do away with the number of hours that you're having to spend creating or updating spreadsheets. It should really be dragged in from all the kind of systems across the council, and it's my understanding that we've got other ways of being able to do that maybe a bit better than we've done that in the past.
No, you're absolutely correct. And we had the workshop last week, which was exactly about that and how we don't need to have all of our systems speaking to each other, but actually these processes can be knitted together so that basically anything that's in an electronic format, any Excel spreadsheets, the amount of data that we gather at a click of a button, you absolutely can interrogate that and it would be there. And that would automatically, and they gave the lovely example of the new start forms. So if a new member of staff starts, how long it would actually take one of our own physical members of staff to do, and then how many seconds it would take for the virtual worker to process that. So that's absolutely what we're looking at doing. And I think it would be fair to say Alistair's going to present on the information that the NHS have available there, certainly significantly ahead of our organisation, and we hope that would show you what our aspiration is. We're not there absolutely yet, but it's an important step change, I think, for us to be there, and it's good for us, I think, as officers to be able to visualise what it could look like, and certainly for myself as Chief Exec to have financial information at my fingertips, you know, to share with directors first thing on a Monday morning so that you've got that weekly. That's exactly the type of proactive information that we would want.
Councillor Milligan.
Thanks for that, Grace. It's quite interesting seeing this for the first time. Obviously, we've had quite a few discussions on it, but actually seeing how it works is actually really interesting. I'm just wondering if at the back of this, I'm going to take it that you're looking at, for example, health boards and other places that have brought it in and how they're using it and actually try and pack the best part that's going to come into here. What is likely to be the cost of bringing the service in and the cost of maintaining the data analytics in comparison to the savings that can be driven and the efficiencies that can be driven? Is there any data available to us just now to sort of see what the overall benefit is to the council on this system?
So in the advice that we've taken so far, whoever we decide to engage with to take this forward have advised that we should be expecting a 200% return on investment. So if we're not likely to see that level of return, it's not worth automating the systems. So the next piece of work, like William's saying about mapping out finance, health and safety, it would be a case of us to scope out what our top three or top five projects actually are. But certainly if it's not something that's going to give us that massive return, it's probably not worth us going down that automated route. But certainly the City of Edinburgh have implemented that across the board. There was one example of parking permits, for example, that they introduced automation from beginning to end for that service. So you also need to work out, do you want an end-to-end process, or do you want the automation to be only part of that process? Because some pieces of some analysis will require a human intervention, if you like, so you just need to be careful about that. But a 200% return on investment is what we're expected to achieve. And of course, you can also have a managed service, so you don't necessarily have to purchase all of this, and that has advantages that we can see in terms of not having to upgrade systems, but we're only in the early stages of discussing what might be the best option.
Councillor Milligan.
Sorry, could you just help me understand that statement part about if we're not getting a 200% return, it's no worth investing in it? I would have thought if we were getting a 150% return, it would have been worth investing in it. I would have thought any additional return. If you could just help me understand the logic of that part of it.
I think that would help us map out what our priorities are going to be. So we should start with those projects that would give us at least the 200%. But yeah, I'm absolutely with you. Anything that saves. Yeah.
And clearly this is an officer-led project at the moment, and we're having an early insight into the type of output that we could enjoy here in the Audit Committee and throughout the Council. My suspicion is that there will be a more detailed paper coming forward to us with background costings, details of the competitive tendering, of the functionality, but this is just an early insight. So in terms of the presentation, the councillors are not being asked to make any decisions today, but simply to observe. Are there any further questions?
No, but just may I just say that I'm very impressed by what I've just seen, because that really is going to be a useful tool for the council.
Alistair?
Yeah. We, in the best interest of integration, there's an issue with the laptops talking to each other.
Costas Vallister. Councillor Hardy.
You can put it down to any level you really want. So that one of those is around the number of completed appraisals. So it'll tell you what that number is, and you can split that down into particular areas. But you could put the information on. The question is ever is what value that would bring. But if it's this lets me know where my team is, who's due an appraisal, who's not, that sort of thing, then it is just, if the information's available, it can be pulled onto a system, so it can move away from paper-based and put it into a centralised system.
Yeah, that's exactly why we had the automation workshop. So our aspiration would be, it's not really for us for internal system, this is good to share, but absolutely to benefit the customers. So the example that we shared about the parking permits in Edinburgh, that sped that up. Somebody could put their application in within a couple of days, they get their permit back. So it's to make sure that the customer really gets the best possible information. And for us to have a one-stop shop, I mean, you do a lot on your phones, don't you? You can travel the world just using your phone, so our aspiration would be that we have that up-to-date technology.
I suppose it was my parking permit, in case anybody's really interested, which I did come back to me within 3 days. But I suppose part of that's also around in the work we've been trying to do through the and kind of commissioner system, which is around that kind of the citizen account and being able going in and that engagement that allows you to order things. Edinburgh did introduce waste, garden waste. It was all online. There was no phone calls or anything else. You went online, you paid your fee, everything else, and something gets sent out back to you. So the interaction with a member of staff was pretty much zero, because you were able to go in through a secure process in doing that, and it gave people just their own control over what it is they needed to do.
Thank you, Alistair. Thank you very much indeed. Item 5.1, for the record, the reference back to council papers previously submitted. Are we happy to note these and move on? In which case, item 5.2, Treasury Management Mid-Year Review.
Thanks, Chair. So we brought forward to Audit Committee the Treasury Management Mid-Year Review Report. That report had been taken to Council on the 13th of December. Members will recollect that was highlighted in the recent internal audit, that we needed to bring the papers to Audit Committee in the first instance. But we felt it was important to take that to Council on the 13th so it can be considered alongside the capital strategy that was on the Council agenda. So going forward, the next Treasury report will be the Treasury strategy, the approval, quite a critical report for Audit Committee, and we've rearranged the date of the Audit Committee in January to allow that to be considered in advance of the February Council meeting. So this is the last time that we've got that diary timing issue to resolve. In terms of the report itself, it is the mid-year report, so it's very much a factual report that informed Council of what had happened in the first half of the year and the forecast Treasury activity for the remainder of the year. Section 3 of the actual report, which is on page 20 of the agenda, sets out the key economic activity for the year, and Section 4 sets out the Treasury management activity to date, which is in line with the strategy that Council approved back in February 2018. We have a summary in Table 1 of the Council's loan portfolio. So that's the borrowing that we've undertaken to finance capital investment in houses, schools, etc. And at the 30th of September, that totalled just shy of £231 million, with a borrowing requirement of £275 million. So that means that the borrowing required to fund our assets, we'd funded 44 of that internally from reserves and working capital. Table 2 across the page sets out the investments of the Council, which at 30th of September were just over £74 million. I'll give members an update on the position as of today. And that's really taking our reserves across General Fund, Housing Revenue Account and Capital Fund, and cash backing those reserves by the investment vehicles that are set out in the report. Section 5 looked ahead to what was expected in the second half of the year and highlights that we've got £10 million of PWLB borrowing that was maturing the Thursday after Council. We had already financed that through a forward loan with Fanbrief, so that was a loan that we signed off a couple of years ago, and we had a set rate for a forward loan. So that gave us certainty, de-risked the rate that we were going to be able to borrow the money at, and avoided any cost to carry with borrowing it from PWLB earlier than might have been necessary. Section 6 of the report provides an update on the prudential indicators, and Section 7 just set out a range of other issues relating to Treasury management. Provost, happy to take... Chair, happy to take any comments on the report. What I thought it might also be helpful for members, and it wasn't part of the report to Council, was just to give you an appraisal of the investments we hold today. So I can circulate that and also pass it to Janet for the minutes. I've also circulated with that a summary that we have of the investment position across Scotland from the Treasury Management Forum, and I think that might allay some of the members' concerns as to where we are investing our money and where others are investing money as well. So with your indulgence, if I can just hand that round.
Thank you. I think you may have anticipated a question.
So I'm conscious that the report that you saw on the agenda sets out the investment position back in September. So it is historic. The two pages that have circulated, the first one with the grey graph, just highlights where Scottish councils have reserves invested and the value across Scotland, significant values across quite a... And the bulk of the investments are at the left-hand side of the table. What I've highlighted on there with the little asterisks are those institutions where the Council has resources invested. And as of last night, our investment portfolio was as per the second sheet of paper. So we have investments yesterday evening at £84.4 million. As I say, they're across the vehicle... The investment vehicles that are asterisked on the front page. I suppose two things. One, to give you an up-to-date position to complement the information in the report, but also supposed to give you reassurance that we're investing in organisations along with other councils. So we have, as of yesterday, £50 million invested in two local authorities. You'll see that across Scotland that's over £500 million of such investments. We have an investment with the Bank of Scotland of £20 million in a 175-day notice account. There is over £300 million of local government reserves in Scotland invested in Bank of Scotland and that theme. the investment decisions we've talked about before at Audit Committee being made by the Treasury team, supported by Link Asset Services, our respected Treasury advisor, who we've procured their services for a number of years. And really, the Treasury mid-year report reinforces that the activity, both in terms of funding capital investment through borrowing and investing reserves, is done in accordance with the Treasury management strategy and aims to ensure that the Treasury management has a positive impact on the Council's financial position. The report's considered at 2.1 highlighted at quarter two monitoring that we've managed to deliver an underspend against the Treasury management budget in the year of over £1.2 million. And indeed, as Council papers come forward for the financial strategy, we'll see a contribution towards easing the financial pressures for future years through effective Treasury management. Happy to take any questions on the report or the other information. Hopefully that gives members a good appraisal of the position we were in at the mid-year.
Mr. Devink. Well, on page 19, I was very pleased to read that the Prudential Code recommends that the main Treasury Management Report are presented to the Audit Committee in advance. We asked for that quite some time ago, and we were told, no, that wasn't possible, but I'm very glad that the Auditor General came to my rescue and that we are now having it in the future. I am still surprised that we get this very informative paper, but which I still find not very easy to read. What is exactly our position as far as our borrowings is concerned? Are we really lending, are we putting money on deposit by the Bank of Scotland or local authorities of 500 million? Or am I reading that all wrong? It would be very helpful also on page 25. I have a question mark at the bottom. It is proposed that permission be granted to borrow up to 497 million, as shown in the table above. And again, I have a concern about page 27 at the very top, where the UK bank's ring fencing is something that I find difficult to understand when you call it riskier activities. So maybe you could give us a bit of background on those issues. Thank you.
Gary?
Yeah, very, very happy to do so. So just to reiterate, the first table is the position across all of Scotland. As I say, the investment in Bank of Scotland is around three. As at the 31st of October, across the Scottish local authorities, the investment position was some £300 million. And the stars are those investment vehicles in Midlothian News, and the second page gives our position with our investments in those individual organisations as of last night. So that's bang. Well, bang up to date, depending on what's happened today, of course. But at 31st of October, Scotland had invested £300 million in the Bank of Scotland. As of last night, Midlothian Council had an investment of £220 million. So our share of that £300 million is, on a like-for-like basis, about £20 million. So that's the national position at 31st of October, and then the Midlothian position as of yesterday evening. Does that answer that question, Mr. Devink?
And what is the red counterparty list red? What does that mean? Goldman Sachs and the Bank of Scotland are concerned.
So our Treasury management advisors provide us with a list of counterparty limits, which are their risk assessment process goes through, and it's colour coded. And I think it's set out in the Treasury Management Report what the various ones are. I don't have that to hand, but I can certainly come back in terms of the, for future reports, provide a breakdown of counterparty risks. but what we have made what we do make sure is that the investments that we choose are within the counterparty limits that are set out in the Treasury Management Strategy. So I think perhaps my intention would be that for future Treasury Management reports, this information in terms of the national position is included for you, and we can articulate the links through to the report more clearly than I could do by picking it up last night and giving you the sort of flash information. And that will then provide a better link to the counterparty limits and the narrative that is in the report.
Mr. Devink?
Yeah. And is it, if somebody like the Warrington Borough Council and the Plymouth City Council, are they guaranteed by the Bank of England that if anything went wrong with them, that we would get our £15 million back?
As far as I'm aware, they're not guaranteed by the Bank of England. We will have the covenant through the local government financial arrangements in England in terms of the, and as far as, you know, there has been no instance of a local authority not being able to repay its investments on the treasury markets. If that was the case, then we would certainly have not made those investments, or the risk and the return that would be associated with such investments would be significantly different. Even Northamptonshire Council, who's been in dire straits, having had a Section 141 notices served, has not been in a position where it hasn't been able to meet its obligations in terms of Treasury activity. So I suppose, from my perspective, local authorities, whether in Scotland or England, come with a very strong financial covenant that they will be able to meet their Treasury obligations in terms of borrowing.
I can't get my head round it, that we are really lending to the Warrington Borough Council and at 1%, and we can get with the Bank of Scotland and Bank Santander in excess of that figure. I feel that really, as a council, one really ought to look at we should not put any money on deposits with other institutions than purely British banks. And that is the safest way, because if anything will happen, then we will regret that we ever put money away, and 15 million is still a great deal of money.
I think there'll be an opportunity when the Audit Committee meets in January to consider the Treasury Management Strategy in advance of Council. So it's a Treasury Management Strategy that will determine the investment appetite for the Council, what counterparties we can lend to, what the limits are associated with those. And I think that will give Audit Committee the opportunity to inform Council, but ultimately it's the decision sits with Council in terms of what its Treasury Management Strategy will be. I hear what you say in terms of the various vehicles to invest in. Shifting the investment strategy around will in turn have direct implications on the revenue budget. In terms of the return that we have on those investments, and that's part of the decision making that Council will have to make in terms of so we could move to a position, I suppose the most risk adverse position is putting the money in the investing money directly with government through the Debt Management Office, which will have a very low return. So the average interest rate here is about 9.91%. The DMO would be, if you're lucky, 0.25%. That would have probably around about £500,000 per annum impact on the revenue budget by that decision. So I think these investments are within the strategy set by Council. Audit Committee has the opportunity in January to consider that before it goes to Council, so that when we move into next financial year, if that strategy needs to be different, Council can do it informed by Audit Committee.
Councillor Milligan.
Yes, thanks. on that, Gary, that would be fine. Would it be possible for you to identify what the change to the revenue budget would be by shifting to the areas that Peter's talking about, and what risks would be mitigated by that, as in opposed to what financial cost that would be to the council when you're presenting that report?
Yeah, if I could come in here. I think what Peter is saying is not what you're describing. He's not talking about going to very, very low return Bank of England deposits. It's talking about going purely to UK financial institutions, which are guaranteed by the UK government, as indeed the Scottish banks have been. My understanding is that West Lothian, who are also advised by Link, do not invest in anything unless it has that degree of support. Now, there's probably a definitional issue here about what is a British bank and what has got the government support. Clearly, from the very helpful schedule you produced, Scottish councils take a wide range of views in treasury management. It was interesting to see that some other Scottish councils are putting money with Qatar and Abu Dhabi, which I don't think we would ever want to do as a council. But on the other hand, some of these entities, the liquidity funds, Federated, I probably ought to know who they are, if we're not aware of them, and there's a crash at some time in the next 10 years somewhere in Scotland, we would feel perhaps rather embarrassed that we had put money with an entity that did not have the government standing behind it in any shape or form.
Certainly happy to take away from this audit committee in terms of, as we develop the strategy for next financial year, what the impact would be of a further restriction on terms of the treasury management activity. You appreciate, and the other question that was asked by Mr. Devink was around the ring fence in the UK banks. So that ring fencing and restructuring our banks has changed the risk exposure as well in terms of which ones and to what extent banks have got effectively a gold-plated government guarantee. So we need to be mindful of that in terms of the work that we do to assess it. The other thing that we need to take account of is counterparty limits. So what we've got is a limit for example, of Bank of Scotland and others. We have headroom, for example, in the Royal Bank of Scotland, but that's returning 0.2 at present in terms of the... So there are. It's a matter of having the flexibility within the Treasury strategy, not only to secure the best, the lowest risk on the investment, but also to spread that risk through the use of a range of counterparties. We're happy to take on those comments in terms of now as we develop over the second half of the year the next strategy. That's really helpful.
Councillor Muirhead.
Just on the counterparty limits, Gary, on the Bank of Scotland, I notice on everything else, our investment is either on or below the counterparty limit. But with the Bank of Scotland, we seem to be investing twice as much as the counterparty limit suggests we should be. Am I misinterpreting what that means?
I did this quite late last night, so I think I may have made a mistake in terms of cutting and pasting the data, but I'll take that away and double-check it. Because I've just noticed that myself. So, but I think it's probably down to my IT skills in terms of extracting the data to make it more presentable for you. So apologies for that.
Mr. Devink.
Yeah, I noticed Federated. I've never heard of them. Who are they? 15 million?
So we have arrangements with a range of money market funds and Federated. I think it used to be Federated Prime in terms of a quite a sizeable money market fund that operates and we invest in. We've gone through, I suppose when we set up arrangements with money market funds, we go through a process of due diligence to check them out, the arrangements, etc. And we then look at the investment, the return that they are receiving. And those tend to be low-risk vehicles in terms of investment that give instant access to the funds and a rate of return, as you can see there.
Would they be falling under the Bank of England last security network?
So they're not an investment bank, so I would need to check what covenant need to check the details of the covenant that the three money market funds have in terms of the report. My colleague, Gary Thompson, who runs the Treasury desk, would be able to give me that detail. It's not something that I'm hands-on with day in, day out, I'm afraid.
Councillor Hardy.
Yeah, in terms of the instant access and the various notice periods for the funds, I mean, are these sums that we're needing to frequently access or have much to do with? Because, I mean, I guess I'm kind of the opposite of Mr. Devinkin, that I look at these figures and I think, well, for the rates of return, what's even the point? I mean, if we invested in a stock portfolio of FTSE 100 companies, we'd be expecting a return of about 5% per annum. So I do kind of wonder, we're taking risk for 0.74% here and 0.1% there, and I worry if we're having access to keeping an access to funds that we're maybe not actually accessing over perhaps earning a higher return than we could with the money. And if we're following this sort of Treasury strategy, should we be looking for a greater rate of return than we're currently getting?
I hear what you say. I suppose come back, and I've said it before in committee, the importance of the security of the investment that we're making, the liquidity and then the yield. And what the money market funds do is give us a vehicle. They will then effectively represent a portfolio of investments in stock markets and a portfolio of what would be described as longer-term investments, but a vehicle in which you can then have liquidity around those investments without the risk. To move into property or securities as a longer-term investment, we'd have to recognise that in the short term they could be quite volatile. So the opportunity of market funds is giving that liquidity benefit, for the price being that the rate is still, as you see there. I suppose over the piece, again, we'd reiterate in terms of benchmarking, in terms of the return we've been able to secure on our investments against Scotland, we perform very well. So we are not at odds with what everybody else is doing. And again, it's balancing that, making sure that £84 million is working for the council, because it brings money to the revenue budget and income. But happy to take on that. It's been really helpful in terms of the comments today, in terms of what we do when we bring back the Treasury strategy for Audit Committee to consider, and then council to determine in January, February, which seems like a lifetime away, but is going to be here before we know it.
That being so, I think there's an appetite for us to know a little bit more about the deposit counterparties, their background, liquidity, investment risk, investment strategy. I think, Mr. Devinkin, you'd appreciate that. Jill.
Just a refresh in terms of members, that when we did the self-evaluation of this audit committee, the technical area in terms of Treasury management and your role to scrutinise the Treasury management arrangements, you said it would be helpful if you had a briefing in relation to that. So some of the discussions that Gary and I have been having is around that. So it's possible that we can try and combine a briefing around some of the technical terms and some of the key indicators and things that this committee need to be focused on, and do that as part of the Treasury strategy report in January.
That would be appreciated. Any further questions? Thank you very much. We move then to 5.3 and the Procurement Service Delivery Framework.
Thanks, Chair. Recognising the Audit Committee's role and governance and oversight and the importance of procurement and procurement arrangements, we felt it was important to bring forward these reports for Audit Committee's interest. Two key procurement reports that have come through Council. First of all, the service delivery framework, which really sets out a framework for services to look at in terms of what I would describe simply as the make or buy decision, in terms of do we deliver services ourselves with a directly employed workforce, and in what way do we do that versus going out to procure services from third parties, whether they're voluntary or private sector. And the framework really creates a means to do that assessment and to measure that assessment to make sure that where the council has the resources, it can do the work in-house, and where it can't, it understands the reasoning for putting that work out to the private and other sectors. The procurement strategy really came forward to council as a refresh. It was really timely that we picked up where we were in terms of our procurement journey. I made sure we had a strategy that delivered against the procurement standards that are applied nationally, and also the picked up on some of the more recent issues we've had around the need to strengthen procurement, particularly around contract and supplier management. So that strategy has been through council in August, and really the report just really mainly for audit committee's assurance that the arrangements have been reviewed and are up to date. My colleague Ian Johnston, who is the procurement manager, would have come to talk about this report today, but today is the day that the procurement team goes through its external assessment by Scotland Excel, and for those that don't know, that's the national local government procurement body. So as well as procuring services nationally for us, they also effectively do that assessment of all of Scotland's council's procurement teams in terms of their performance. So we're hoping that we will see improved performance coming through that today. And what I would intend to do is to bring an update on that procurement assessment to Scotland Excel, from Scotland Excel to committee. And if it would help, again, there's the opportunity for Scotland Excel to come in and brief you on where the council is compared with others and the procurement journey we're on. So really both reports for council for audit committee, sorry, to note today, and happy to take any questions.
Can I take up a rather theological question? It's 9.1. We will not use outsourcing to simply deflate employee earnings. Now, I understand we have the augmented minimum wage here, and that we would always seek in anyone wanting to do business with the council that they would pay their employees that. But are we not at a competitive disadvantage, because by and large we will be paying superannuation, and also we, as I understand it, in tendering we're obliged to absorb a certain amount of overhead, whereas a private sector competitor may choose to compete for business at the margin without looking to any overhead recovery, and certainly not looking to final salary pension scheme, because private sector hardly has any now. Isn't there a problem, therefore, in actually implementing this policy?
So I suppose that looks at the decision to take services that are currently provided by the council directly and to outsource them, and that would not be a reason to change the service delivery model. So to take a legal service, sorry, if Con Allan sitting next to me, but to take legal services and simply outsource it so that the people that provide that service are paid less than the people currently within the council who provide it. It really ties in, I suppose, the service delivery framework ties back to a motion that was agreed by council back in October 2011, so it maintains the spirit of that motion, and it also reiterates, I suppose, our commitments as a living wage accredited employer as well. So we're not saying that within that framework that there isn't a decision to be made as to whether services should be provided in-house or externally, but it's saying that we wouldn't only put services out to the private or voluntary sector simply to undermine terms and conditions and earnings in terms of our...
Yeah, but in terms of the competitive environment, take your example of legal services, a private legal firm will not have a final salary pension scheme, but we will generally have final salary pensions for our employees. So how can we ever match on that basis?
And that's what the... So what the framework does is not prejudge that discussion. It creates a framework in which to make the decision. So there may be cost implications such as final salary or career average pension scheme, which is where we are at the moment, but there may be a range of other benefits. But it was really designed to make sure we don't simply put a service out because the person that delivers the service will be paid less than they are if they were employed directly by the council.
You know, the problem is the question of definition of earnings is very open here, and if you decided to cut out the private sector, which perhaps some councillors would like to do, you can say, aha, no final salary pension contribution here, you're unfairly competing with us. And that would be true. And also this point about absorption of overhead makes us uncompetitive.
Again, the framework doesn't try to answer all of those questions. What it does is sets out that's part of the decision-making process. So we would look at the assessment that's made. If someone wanted to change how a service is delivered, we'd expect them to have worked through the framework and answered the questions and done the assessments. So, and at that point, pick up what are the drivers for that service to delivery model to be changed and what are the benefits, the pros and the cons. So it's not a dogmatic, there will be no outsourcing, for example. It just sets that framework to make sure that all the options are considered and we understand the basis on which, I suppose at the end of the day, the elected members will be able to understand the basis on which the decision has been made and the framework within which that decision has been made. But if we had what wouldn't be in compliance with the framework is simply to say that the only reason for outsourcing a service is because the person that delivers the service, in terms of the overall earnings package, will get less than if they were directly employed by the council. That's where the framework would take us. And again, that ties back to the original motion agreed in October 2011. What I would say is that report was at council and was agreed unanimously, if my memory serves me right, so as was the procurement strategy.
I'm not challenging the decision of council, in which I think I abstained. It's simply to say the definition of employee earning is open to interpretation, that's all. Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, I think you're right, Peter. There are a lot of things in there that trying to figure out what the payment to the peoples are. And whilst we have our superannuation and with some of our senior management, backroom costs, etc., what we also find is that the private sector tendering for these have a need to have a profit margin in there that we don't. So therefore, that hopefully balances up. There's always going to be occasions where, effectively, and if you take adult social care, for an example, for us to bring that back in-house at the moment would be quite costly to us. But for us to try and deliver that service just now, it's certainly one of the options we'll have to keep in mind, because these companies that keep coming and continue tendering and tendering at a low rate and they pay or their terms and conditions are significantly behind the council's, pardon me, pay, the living wage, their holiday pay, their sick pay, and their contracts are well behind what the councils have. But one side pulling out or trying to take it in the wood, there's no guarantee that you could deliver that service. So I actually welcome the procurement strategy based on this, that we didn't quite simply say, well, right, we can get this contract for a lower salaries, so therefore we'll go with that, because the reality is, if that company then fail, how do we then pick up that service?
Well, credit risk's another issue, certainly. Shall we leave this on the blackboard and pass on to the next paper? Any further questions? Procurement strategy.
So, Chair, yeah, I suppose I was introducing both those papers together. Again, the procurement strategy being at council, agreed by council, and really sets out what I would hope members saw at the council meeting and audit committee as well, a strong reinforcement of the governance around procurement, so that the arrangements, the governance in place is strong, and with the support of managers and internal audit, we can make sure that the application of that governance is strong, and that will then and then lead to a stronger position in terms of our annual governance statement. So the link from the strong strategy through guidance, through management support and guidance, and applying that with the support of the procurement team overall strengthens our governance and procurement.
Jill.
Yeah, and just to follow on from what Gary was saying, that these are actually linked to the procurement strategy is actually linked to two of the other papers on the agenda, on 5.7 and 5.8, around areas of improvement, and just having those conversations, as Gary mentioned, with service managers so that they clearly understand the rules that they should be complying with and some of the frameworks that are there to, you know, to have that conversation about, you know, different services, which will obviously have different challenges and different ways of, you know, procuring those services. So we're internal audit, we're working with Ian Johnson in terms of the procurement managers, hopefully start having some conversations at department, the directorate management team meetings, hopefully to get that broader awareness and to give them an opportunity to have some conversations around you know, the challenges that you know, are posed for different services. So hopefully that will be a good opportunity going forward.
Thank you. I guess I know the answer to this question. Will improvements in procurement efficiency be capable of being quantified in time for the budget exercise next year?
We've had in the past procurement savings attached to some quite ambitious procurement savings. I think what we see now in or the procurement landscape for Scottish local government, a lot of the contracts and the tenders are fourth, fifth generation, so we've been through the procurement process robustly a number of times. A combination of that, the wider economic climate, the economic uncertainty, I think it's very challenging to see where the headroom is to squeeze further savings out of the prices of the goods we're buying. The next stage that we need to go to, I think, procurement is really around the contract and supplier management to actually make sure we are getting full value for what we're paying for in every single case. And across Scotland, local government, it's an area that it knows is weaker on and needs to improve and a scope for improvement. So it's more about making sure we're getting the best value for what we're paying for rather than being able to really drive budget savings from it going forward, I'm afraid.
So it's unlikely that there will be a number that the officers can propose as part of the budgetary process as being the saving from better procurement for the next financial year's budget?
Yes.
Mr. Devink.
Right. All fascinating, and I hear this robustness word that keeps coming up. But if it was all that robust, how was it possible that Fushi Bridge could have slipped through this very robust procurement strategy?
As you know, we're rather limited in what could be said. Grace.
I think it's one of the actions. That's why we brought forward the new procurement strategy to make clear that we needed the new strategy, but also, as Jill made the point, that was also shared across all managers in the council to ensure that it's not just about having a strategy that sits on a shelf, but we actually enact that day in, day out in order to protect us moving forward.
Thank you. Can we now move to Jill and the page 79, the final internal audit report?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, this is a piece of work relating to following the public pound, a quite complex piece of work, and the way that the report is written is actually set out in a number of different sections, just providing assurance on the different grant streams that the council spends with third parties. Just as a reminder to this committee, our standard process now for our internal audit reports is that we take these through our corporate management team and our strategic leaders group for conversation, and in particular around the following: the public pound. This report it was an important conversation to occur because it does relate to a number of disparate services across the various directorates. In summary, I think it's quite a positive report in terms of assurance. There's a number of good in terms of effective controls. The improvements are really around some of the awareness aspects. So again, looking at that, the framework that exists, and making sure that there's a a refresh of some of those key principles, and that we've got that stewardship of public money at the forefront of everything that we're doing. A good commitment around the action plan and the recommendations in section 5, and a number of pieces of work that are already underway, well underway, to implement the, you know, the recommendations in future. Thanks.
Have we any comments? So everything appears either satisfactory or going to be satisfactory. There's nothing, no fires burning. Thank you for that. We move on to the final internal audit report on the Tyne-esque leader programme, which I believe we are obliged statutorily to report on every year.
Yeah, so this is a slightly different format in terms of report and recognising that mandatory requirement on the EU-funded programme for LEADER. So our testing work is around some of the projects and the roles and responsibilities that Midlothian Council has to play in relation to the Tyne-esque LEADER programme. The assurances around compliance with the service level agreement with the Scottish Government and some of the other agencies. Again, within the report, some positive improvements since the previous year around the implementation of the recommendation. There are a few remaining actions, and again these have been agreed by the relevant officers, and as the programme continues they see these as continuous improvement, and to an extent there is still the risk of EU funding clawbacks, so it's really important to have, albeit it's a mandatory requirement for internal audit to do this piece of work, just to give that sense of testing and some of the compliance on an annual basis while these EU-funded programmes continue to their end in 2020.
These are small-scale type projects. Is there any guidance as to how many of them are failing or succeeding? Mary?
The people that are applying for funding have to give us an update on what they've used the funding for, so they only draw down the money when you know, they've done the piece of work or whatever. So in terms of LEADER, that tends to be more successful than Business Gateway. So, for example, LEADER, they have to report back, whereas in Business Gateway, whilst we support organisations to start up, they used to record how long the businesses were in place. They used to have a sort of recording mechanism, but they've done away with that, whereas LEADER, they have to report back.
So it's about the survival rate of the entities that we've backed here.
It's not just that. It's also about looking at what the conditions of the grant were and making sure that the outcomes in terms of some of the economic benefits in the Tyne-esque area can be evidenced, and that those are materialised, and there is some sustainability checks in relation to that. So whilst the projects might be, you know, early or mid through the 5 or 6 year programme, it's also looking at what were the economic benefits beyond the initiation of the projects.
Thank you. Mr. Devink?
Following up on Jill's last point, I have been observing the Tyne-esque LEADER, and I just can't help thinking that it is quite an administrative divide as far as Midlothian is concerned. I hate to think how much the costs are involved in administrating it, and it would be very helpful if one could have an indication of how much really this exercise is costing us.
Mary?
I can't answer that one directly, Mr. Devink, but I know that in Tyne-esque LEADER, in terms of getting the EU funding, there is administrative costs, but as part of the funding package, but I'd need to check that out, just how much we put in and how much the administrative burden is.
Would be so helpful, thank you. It would be so helpful to really get an idea, you know, what the costs are. I mean, in fundraising, one had a little figure that you should never incur overheads that are more than 10% of the funds raised. It would be interesting to see how the cost of distributing the Thai-esque leader would be in relation to the amount of money that one has got. It's just a good discipline. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, my recollection for internal audit is that Mary's quite right. There is an allowance there that covers our costs. You're also correct that this activity is marginal in the sense that the private sector would not produce it as a sort of equity gap area. So I'm not necessarily concerned about that, but it would be interesting to see the numbers all the same. 5.6, update on progress with implementation of internal audit recommendations.
Thank you. The purpose of this report is to provide audit with an update on the progress with implementation of the recommendations arising from the May 2018 report. Section 2 of the report outlines the background and Section 3, the progress update, including the regular meetings that I have held in order to ensure that progress against the actions were made. The appendix itself highlights the progress made against the 14 original recommendations in the action plan, and I'm pleased to say that Action 6 is now complete and has been approved by CMT. We have also appointed a new roads manager who has now taken up post as outlined in Actions 12 and 13, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Everything seems complete or ongoing, is that correct? There's nothing here that's got a barrier to completion. Let's pass on then. 5.7, update on corporate governance.
Thank you. Again, this is linked a bit to the previous report, so we're just closing down the actions. So the purpose is to provide an update to the Audit Committee on progress with the implementation of the actions associated with the areas for improvement in the annual governance statement. And in terms of our action note at the beginning of the meeting, we were required to provide a quarterly update, so this is really the quarterly update. Section 2 outlines the background, and Section 3, again, the progress made. And in the appendix, I've included the further information on the 7 actions in this case, and the report concludes with one recommendation.
Do you require a mandate for that recommendation? Then, Colm, all happy? Item 5.8 on page 107. Internal Audit Mid-Term Performance Report. Jill.
Thank you, Chair. This is a report format that I use on a regular basis within Scottish Borders Council, and the feedback from the Audit Committee there, and hopefully for members of this Audit Committee, is a useful reminder of the coverage that we've set out within our internal audit plan that this committee approved back in March, but also gives this committee an indication of how the internal audit function are performing against the plan. So in summary, the impact of the ongoing nature of the roads investigation and some other pieces of work means that we are at the half year. We are slightly behind where I'd hoped to be, and these are set out in the table on 3.1 and also in a little bit more detail in the appendix with some commentary. That some of the pieces of work that were slightly delayed from the half year following the public pound, just on today's agenda. The Learning Estate Strategy, we're doing a slightly different piece of work there because of the assurance requirements around that slightly changed during the year. And we've had some conversations with Mary Smith and her team We're going to be involved, or are being involved, in the review of the Learning Estate Strategy, and sharing, being more of a critical friend. So it's some of the things that were as part of our internal audit strategy. So it won't come through as an assurance report. It'll come through more as in terms of our wider activity. Procurement and management of contracts, that's the three pieces of work, again, that this committee will be fairly familiar with. It's a really significant piece of work. We've got all members of our internal audit team allocated on some sample of contracts in relation to that. But again, it's taken a little bit longer just to get into the detail and the complexities of the different contracts that are across the council services as a whole. So each contract is quite different in nature. And the payroll piece of work, we're in discussions at draft report stage with management currently, so we'll hopefully conclude that and bring that report to this committee, hopefully at the January meeting. Section 4 sets out the remaining internal audit plan, and there's a table at 4.4 with kind of behind this within the team. Elaine Greaves, who's our principal internal auditor, she's a detailed work programme of work for each individual within the audit team, and we've looked at that across the remaining a number of months in terms of activity, and we've got a proposal, and we're asking this committee to endorse the proposal for three pieces of work that we, with the current resources for the remainder of the year, won't be able to deliver our planned assurance. So that's set out in section 4.3. Again, there's some further detail in the appendices. We've discussed these three pieces of work with the relevant heads of service and directors, and they are supportive of deferment around the community engagement. It's felt that with the upcoming Best Value Assurance review that's scheduled, that some assurance will come from that national performance review, and the proposal would be to defer that into our 19-20 internal audit plan and look at maybe some of the improvement areas and do some follow-up pieces of work around that. And the other two areas around commercial rents and business gateway. Within our audit universe, it's not absolutely necessary for us to carry out those two pieces of work within within the current year. So a deferment into an early part of 19-20, and then that way we can provide some assurance to management and this committee in due course. So happy to take any particular questions around the content in terms of internal audit performance, but we're looking for this committee to agree to the proposals around deferment of three pieces of work and in light of resources. The other appendix that I've applied, just for background information, is that I engage in the Scottish Local Authorities Chief Internal Auditors Group. It's a really useful forum for sharing of best practice, sharing of ideas around our activity, any emerging areas of risk and development. So it's a really useful forum. So it's really just there for information for the audit committee. So we make a contribution to that committee, but I think we more than get enough back from lessons learned from much larger internal audit teams in some of the larger councils. So I think it's a really beneficial forum to engage in.
Thank you very much. So there are three pieces of work that have slid because of the roads contract issues and the fact that the size of the internal audit team was reduced last year, I believe. But you're volunteering to add three more, which are set up at 4.3, so either way you'll have a busy year. Are there any comments? Councillor Devine, Mr. Devine.
Very impressed by what I have read and what I have heard, but it would be valuable if we could get the external auditor to give his opinion on what he has heard and what he has seen, because it would be helpful for us to understand whether that has also his approval.
Stephen.
Thank you, Chair. I suppose in terms of the few comments, in terms of the process of providing the Audit Committee with regular updates is very helpful, and from a governance perspective, one I would expect to see. It rather ties into the next paper that's in terms of the shared arrangements. You'll recall that in my first year as external auditor, I commented on the need for the Council, and I'm paraphrasing the report at this stage, to enhance the skills and capacity with an internal audit. Clearly, with the joint arrangements, and not wishing to be personal, but Jill joining on a 0.5 basis as a shared resource between Borders and here, I commented last year in my annual audit report that I think that goes some way to enhancing the arrangements for internal audit. Clearly, through the planning process and for internal audit, that it will be important that the focus of internal audit remains entirely appropriate or focused on the key risks facing the Council, and those will inevitably evolve. So in terms of ensuring that the work this year is completed, although a little behind, then that's going to be important to provide the assurance to this committee and also to support the governance statement and next year's financial statements. And then clearly, as Jill and the team do the planning for next year, the input of the Audit Committee in relation to where internal audit is planning to focus for 19-20 financial year will be, as I say, an important element to factor in to ensure that you as an Audit Committee are content with those areas, and that those areas are addressing the key risks and providing you with the assurance required.
There being no further comments, we are asked on page 113 to note the progress and approve the revised internal audit plan. Are we all content? We are content. Thank you very much. Shared internal audit services. Grace.
Thank you. The purpose of this report is to gain approval to the proposal to continue with the shared internal audit services between Midlothian and the Scottish Borders, which will also create the opportunity for a wider exploration of joint working activities and benefits. Section 2 outlines the background, and Section 3 outlines the outcomes of the pilot phase that we've just gone through. The report also concludes with two recommendations to endorse the continuation of the shared internal audit services, but also to note that there may be benefits in wider exploration of joint working. I would also like to say, just on a personal level, I've enjoyed working with Jill. I think she's brought a different perspective on the work of internal audit, and certainly I think it allows the organisation to be safer to have a chief internal auditor reporting directly to myself as chief exec. So it's been a welcome addition, and something that I think would make us stronger moving forward.
Thank you. So we endorse the continuation of the shared internal audit service, and note that there will be wider exploration of joint working associated with the short and longer term across the councils. My own plea is that at last we have a session away from this forum for the audit committee to look at things as suggested, like fraud across Scotland and fraud awareness and any other germane topics that reflect the internal audit function, as well as the wider question of accountancy for Scottish local authorities. Financial overview to risk management update. Thank you, Chief Executive. Chris Lawson, of course. We have a separate paper, 510.
Thank you very much, Chair. This report highlights the risks facing the Council at quarter two. The report indicates that the Council continues to face challenges, particularly around financial stability, the change programme and balancing the budget in future years. The UK decision to leave the European Union has seen some public sector organisations such as the NHS and others develop contingency arrangements for the potential exit without a deal. This is an area that Council services have been given consideration to, particularly where there are business critical functions or services reliant on goods and services from within the EU. further report will be made to the Council Management Team setting out the anticipated impact and the preparatory arrangements taken to mitigate the damaging impacts that this may cause. During the revision of the risk profile this quarter, there were additional risks identified and added to the strategic risk profile. These included the 1140 hours early years expansion and cyber security. The risk profile summary presented at 2.4 sets out the top issues facing the Council at present, the range of risks facing the Council, and the opportunities before the Council. Audit Committee is recommended to note the Quarter 2 Strategic Risk Profile Report and consider the current response to the issues, risks and opportunities highlighted as set out in Appendix 1.
Are we comments? Will the risk assessment at some stage be updated when the outcome of the roads investigation is fully known?
Yes, as soon as the investigation is concluded, we'll update the risk register appropriately, and if there are actions that need to be taken, they'll be reflected in the risk register until they're managed through.
There being no comments, could I ask Gary to speak to the cheerful subject of the financial overview 2017-18, local government in Scotland.
So just as a bit of background, the Accounts Commission will consider two reports for local government. The first one you have in front of you here, the financial overview, and then there'll be a further report some point in the new year published in terms of more wider issues. The report was published, I think, the day before the Audit Committee agenda came out. Given the importance of it, given the importance of other papers you've seen around the financial sustainability of the Council and financial management, we felt it was important to bring this immediately forward to the first Audit Committee. Normally we bring them with a management commentary, but we felt best to get it on the agenda and allow members to consider the report. The report's structured around the summary of findings, which I'll touch on, and it looks at the overall position, and this is overall position for councils in terms of budgets and spending for the last financial year. The financial year ended in March 18. The Accounts Commission's assessment of the council's financial position. It also touches on the position with integrated joint boards, and I think in terms of probably even in terms of when you see the national position on integrated joint boards, it reinforces the strong position that Midlothian is in. And it then touches on the outlook for councils, which it describes as remaining challenging. Throughout the document, the actual report itself is supported with a number of other tools on the Accounts Commission website in terms of backup data and web links. Throughout the document as well, there's also question marks highlighted, which are really targeting areas where councillors would want to ask questions around the report. So it's the structure of the report and the support information is probably very helpful to members in terms of your scrutiny role. If I turn to the summary, there's seven key messages, and I suppose the overall one is councils have managed funding gaps of 4% in the net expenditure budgets of some £12 billion. So that's how much local government spends. And that's been managed mainly through savings and the planned use of reserves. So that's how councils have responded to the funding challenge by cutting services and using up reserves. And that really recognises, I suppose, the first key message that councils are reliant on Scottish Government for a significant part of their funding, and that is reduced in cash terms in 17-18 by .6%. And in real terms, that represented a 2.3% reduction, some nearly quarter of £1 billion real terms reduction. Touched on the funding gaps of 4% and highlights that councils are under pressure to find different ways to fund and deliver services. In 17-18, 24 councils increased council tax, where in 18-19, all councils increased their council tax. It highlights that spending is shifting, so we've seen an increase in spending in education and social work, and that's funded and offset by reductions in spending in other services, so a shift to those two areas. 18 councils ended the year with reserves that were lower than at the start, and total usable reserves across Scotland fallen by some £18 million, a relatively small amount, but it's still a reduction. And I suppose you get below that into individual how councils are holding reserves. You'll be aware that Midlothian Council's position in terms of HRA and general fund are starkly different. Funding for IJB has increased, and it does highlight the majority of IJBs have underlying financial sustainability issues. 20 of the IJBs across Scotland incurred deficits or were dependent on additional funding from the partners. Highlights the funding outlook for reductions in Scottish Government funding and continued and increasing financial pressures on council services, especially those that are not protected. I suppose it's important to read that across the Stephen E. Wise report that came through in terms of the annual report, the acute financial position of this council, not only the national position hit and miss, but also the specific pressures as being the fastest growing council and that unique position that puts us in a very acute financial position going forward. And as we've heard with the risk report, the impact of EU withdrawal highlighted in the report, I suppose, or Scotland couldn't have produced the report without referencing that. That's a very quick run through the key messages. There's a lot of good context and information in the report, and it highlights a number of questions that for councillors, both audit committee councillors and more widely. I suppose pause there on the key messages, but happy to take any questions in terms of the overall content of the report. Thanks.
Mr. Devink.
Well, it was quite a piece of paper and a lot of reading and quite a lot of, not all of it was so obvious. And it would probably be very helpful if we, in the meeting on the 29th of January, have the kind of report and evaluation from the officers how Midlothian fares in this whole report. So maybe we could do that. It would be helpful to have, because there really was an awful lot of reading into it, and while I did read most of it, I couldn't interpret it the way that you have just done. So if we could have that, I think that would be a benefit to all of us.
Gary?
I think that would be really helpful to perhaps just for the meeting to note the report, but continue it to discuss it more fully at the January meeting, give everybody time to digest it, because even as officers, we've just really had an initial read through of the report. So welcome that opportunity.
Councillor Milligan? Ooh, you're just looking pensive, like Rodin's thinker over there. A few things fly off the page. This reduction of only £18 million, that's very surprising. But I suppose in Midlothian's case, we look as if we've got very good reserves in the tables here because of the strength of the housing revenue account and the housing capital account. And that therefore goes back to an issue we've all debated about the flexibility to move from one reserve or to another or not, as the case may be. Also, we're conscious earlier on in our discussion that our borrowings are shooting up here because of the growth of Midlothian from a cap of, I think, £334 million to something like £480 million, and yet we're not apparently a particularly geared local authority, judging by the tables here. But that issue of over-leveraging, over-borrowing, perhaps will be something we can debate in January.
Yeah, happy to pick up those specifics. And we, in terms of the borrowing position, and again, you'll have the benefit of the Treasury Management Strategy in January, in terms of which is, you know, really again reinforce the borrowing to support the growth in our infrastructure, principally as a result of the growing population, and also see where we are with the position of overall reserves at that point.
Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, Peter, sorry, I was just trying to get in colour there to try and figure out what this was, and it was actually talking about like, the usable reserves, because I see Midlothian coming out as second highest, but when you strip out the HRA account, they're saying him. But is there, and I can't find a chart in here at all, that sort of gives an indication of where we lie throughout Scotland if you strip that part out?
Again, I haven't had the opportunity to go through the report as fully as I would like. It's really, I think, Exhibit 7, the way the bar charts are, if that's what you call them, are set out, makes it quite hard to just see. We intend, this, again, picking up on the EY annual report, we said that we'd bring a reserve strategy forward to February Council for Council to consider before it sets the budget. So I would like to, as part of that, just get a feel for the position across Scotland. I do have some benchmarking information through the Directors of Finance section, and that would form part of that consideration of a reserve strategy, so give you a better understanding of where other councils are sitting in the reserves position.
Councillor Muirhead.
I actually find that chart very helpful because it, I mean, right away, that illustrates, sorry, on page 20 of the report, the one that Derek was talking about usable reserves, the colour scheme thing there, I mean, you can spot right away the commitment that we've got to the house building programme when it's, you know, you can see the huge big green bit and there that's way in excess percentage-wise in any other council. So for our size, we're performing really well in terms of the amount of commitment that we've got to our council housing programme. And I take it that the large yellow bit above that is will be a lot to do with the school estate, capital for the school estate. So it's actually quite, I find that quite informative, actually. It's a good report in general for information, if you've got it in colour. If you're using your iPad, as you should be.
Yeah, but it still leaves our general reserve right on the line. A very small general reserve, and other councils have apparently high reserves, but they've got to hold a lot in reserve because of contaminated land. So these columns need to be treated with a great deal of care.
Is that Exhibit 7 that you were referring to?
Exhibit 7. So we can have some more fun with this in January, in the context of approaching decisions on our own budgets. Thank you very much for bringing it quickly, though. There's a lot of good stuff in it.
Sorry, would it be possible to have EY's view also on this report and how it relates to Midlothian? Because that would be so helpful for us.
Stephen.
Thank you, Chair. So probably useful to understand the context of the report. So as appointed auditors across all 32 local government bodies in Scotland, as appointed auditors, we submit the annual audit report. So the annual audit report that I presented here at the end of September went to the Controller of Audit. They amass all of those annual audit reports, and this is a summation of the key issues emerging across, reported by all the appointed external auditors, together with some additional research that they've done in data analysis, so the Exhibit 7 that's just been subject to discussion. So I suppose what I'm saying is this report will encapsulate my views in terms of, together with the annual audit report and the views of other external auditors in terms of what we are seeing across Scotland's local government community.
Thank you. Councillor Muirhead?
No, well, almost.
I just wanted to ask something at the end of the agenda, because we jumped on from the minutes quite quickly to the presentation, and there was a point that Alistair made about the staff debt being 821,000, and I was wondering if we've got any information as to how much of that do we have arrangements with the employees to recover? You know, because I think that would be an important bit of information.
Do you want to come back at the next meeting on that?
We can bring something back with an update on that. Actually, in the feedback we got, actually what we're saying was it would be helpful for the audit committee to see a report on where we've been, where we are now. So if that's an action, we can take that away.
If that could be, Janet, put in the minutes. And looking forward to the next meeting, Janet.
Yes, we've received apologies from Mike Ramsay for the next meeting, so I don't know if you'd like to appoint a chair for that one in advance.
This is highly irregular, but we need a seconder.
Thank
you. I'll chair the next meeting and look forward to seeing you all in the new year.